The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Or Ray at RTE.ie. Did you know that you can survive longer without food than without sleep? And finally, it seems that people, when I say people, scientists and medical people are taking sleep seriously. And if you want to gen up on sleep, can I recommend a brilliant book to you? It's The Nocturnal Brain, Nightmares, Neuroscience and the Secret World of Sleep. And it's by our next guest, Guy Lishner. Good afternoon, Guy.
Afternoon, Ray.
Good to talk to you. So you're a neuroscientist and you specialise in sleep.
Yeah, I'm actually a neurologist rather than a neuroscientist.
Sorry.
So I see
patients. There's a difference. Yes. Sorry about that. You're a neurologist. And why sleep? Why did you decide on sleep?
Well, I think that sleep, as we now know, influences really every aspect of our lives. It influences our physical health, our brain health, but also our psychological health. That was rather unappreciated until recent years. But from a neurologist's perspective, we know that sleep is really important to a whole range of neurological conditions like epilepsy, like headache, like cognition. So things like dementia or other problems with memory.
So we sort of up until recently just tolerated sleep. It was a time when we couldn't do the stuff we wanted to do.
It was very much seen as a distraction from getting on with your daily life. It was an inconvenience rather than a fundamental part of our lives. I think we've moved very much away from that now, in that we recognise that sleep is actually fundamental to every aspect of our lives. And thankfully, people are now starting to appreciate the importance of sleep and are prioritising sleep to some extent.
Yeah. And sleep is different for individuals. And for individuals, it changes as we go through life.
Absolutely. So we know that in childhood, obviously, we need much more sleep. And as we get older, the amount of sleep that we get lessens. But it's not just the amount of sleep. It's also the nature of sleep and the quality of sleep that changes. So, for example, when babies are born in a premature state, they'll often spend about a third of their lives in rapid eye movement, or what we sometimes euphemistically term dreaming sleep. Whereas actually, as we get older, that amount of dreaming that we do, or REM sleep, changes dramatically. So actually probably only constitutes about 15 to 10% in very late adulthood.
Isn't it amazing that something that we do for a third of our lives has gotten so little attention from the scientific community over the years?
I think that's absolutely right. One of the problems is that we've only had the tools to properly study sleep in the last few years.
And what are those tools, Guy?
Well, we've known that the EEG, which is the test that we do, for example, for things like epilepsy, where we put electrodes on people's scalps and record their brain waves, give us some information about what the brain is doing. But in recent years, we've had a whole host of other techniques, things like genetics, like a type of scanning called functional imaging, which enables us to actually see the function of the brain rather than the structure of the brain, have really pushed our knowledge of sleep forward dramatically. And there are also some very large-scale studies now in terms of looking at populations and how much sleep they get and the nature of the sleep they get and the associations with other health issues. So technology has really driven this forward, and as technology has driven this forward, interest has also been increased. Yeah. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle.
I suppose when you're in a pub or out, wherever you might go, and you're talking to people who've never met you before and you tell them what you do, they all want to know, well, how much should I be sleeping? What answer do you give them?
It's actually quite a difficult answer to give. I mean, if you look at populations as a whole, we know that things like increased risk of heart attacks, of strokes, of general ill health, even mortality, increase at the margins of the sleep duration. So if you're sleeping less than 6 hours, your risk of mortality and risk of a whole other host of conditions increases. And if you're sleeping too long, that's also the case. Although one of the theories behind an increased risk with increased amounts of sleep is probably because you're sleeping a prolonged period of time because you've got other health issues. But I think that it's important to remember that this 7 to 8 hours of sleep, which is usually what's quoted, it is the case for the general population, but it's not necessarily specific to you.
Okay.
We know that the amount of sleep you need is related to what genes you carry, but also the quality of the sleep that you're getting. So, for example, I have some families, all of whom need 4 or 5 hours a night's sleep and don't seem to have any ill consequences during the day, and other families who need 9 or 10 hours. Okay. I guess the optimal amount of sleep is the amount of sleep that you're getting in order to wake up feeling refreshed, not to feel tired during the day, and then be ready for sleep at the same time the following night.
Uh-huh. The function, and I know it's multifaceted, but
yeah.
The main functions of sleep, what are they?
So we think that deep sleep, or what we term stage 3 non-REM sleep, is largely about restoration of function. It's about healing. It's about rejuvenation. If we look at the brain in particular, there are channels within the brain called the glymphatic system, which is a series of channels, a network that allows fluid to pass through them. And when we look at the brains of animals during deep sleep, during stage 3 sleep, we see that those channels open up to about 60%. And so what we think is happening in that stage of sleep is actually the brain is being cleansed of toxins, of the byproducts of being active and being awake for prolonged periods of time. So there is an element of physical housekeeping. Yeah. But we also know that what tends to happen in all stages of sleep to some extent is that the connections between various cells and various parts of the brain are constantly being tweaked. So that's important for memory. It's important for linking up different parts of the brain, and is part of the electrical housekeeping of the brain as well.
Okay. Now, that flushing out of the brain, that's relatively new information, and it's very exciting information, because I suppose then we know that if that happens during sleep, we can ask the question, what happens if it's not been flushed out effectively, if we don't get enough sleep? And what's the answer to that question?
Well, I think the short answer is we're not quite sure.
Okay.
But what is being proposed is that poor quality sleep or continuous sleep deprivation, chronic sleep deprivation, may be an important risk factor for certain conditions like Alzheimer's disease. We know now that even after a single night's sleep deprivation, there are significant changes to certain proteins in the brain that have been implicated in the generation or the underlying pathology of Alzheimer's disease. And so there is a growing literature now regarding the association between sleep deprivation, chronic sleep deprivation, and risk for Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Now, it's an amazing book because it has all that scientific information and what's happening and what might happen in the future, but it also has stories, case studies from your work as a neurologist, as opposed to when you're a scientist. So can we go through a few of those then? Well, let's take John then. John, who was being aggressive to his wife while he was asleep, completely out of character to John during the day.
So John's wife began to report that he was shouting out and lashing out, punching and kicking in the night, which, as you say, is completely out of keeping for him. During the day, he's extremely mild-mannered, a very gentle soul. And when we brought him into the sleep lab, what we could see is that he was doing that in the sleep lab setting, but was doing this during dreaming sleep. So normally when we're in rapid eye movement sleep, which is the stage of sleep that we most associate with dreams of a narrative structure, and what I mean by that is a story evolving, a film-like plot, we're generally completely paralyzed. The only muscles that continue to work are the muscles that allow us to breathe and the muscles that move our eyes from left to right, which is why it's called rapid eye movement sleep. But in some individuals, that mechanism of paralysis, that switching on of that paralysis that is part and parcel of rapid eye movement sleep, doesn't work. And in those individuals, what people do is they act out their dreams, particularly those dreams of a violent or an aggressive nature. And that's what John was doing. So, for example, he would dream of being chased by a tiger, of just about to be bitten, and then he would lash out or kick out at that tiger, but unfortunately would do that to his wife, resulting in her injury.
And how was that solved then?
So that was, in his case, it was treated by generally improving his sleep, but also some medication. We know that there are a number of different options in terms of medication to try and improve that. They usually don't make it disappear completely, but they cause a significant improvement in this aspect of sleep. And actually, he was subsequently, having spent quite some time sleeping in a different bed from his wife, to get back into bed with her.
Now, I've spoken to a man who has Lewy body dementia, and he told me vividly, a vivid description of his night terrors, which sounded similar to John's. Is there a link between the two?
Yes, I think that those night terrors that your person was describing is actually probably the same condition as what John was experiencing, which is something called REM sleep behavior disorder. Yeah. And we used to think that this was a condition that was idiopathic, which really means that we don't understand what's causing it. But it certainly had been very frequently reported in people with Parkinson's disease and dementia with Lewy bodies. What we now understand is that sometimes this condition can be a predictor of developing these conditions, sometimes right. coming on as early as 10 or 20 years before the onset of these conditions. And in fact, it's probably a very early warning sign that whatever the process that's going on that is generating Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia is actually starting in a different part of the brain, an area of the brain called the brainstem, which is really responsible for generating that paralysis in REM sleep.
Okay, that was Kevin Quaid who spoke to us about Lewy body dementia. Parasomnia, is that an umbrella term for walking in your sleep, talking in your sleep, doing that sort of thing? Is it?
Yes, it's any unwanted behaviour in sleep.
Oh, sleep,
really.
Okay, yeah, a parasomnia. So Jackie, she was able to drive and go on her motorbike while asleep.
Yeah, I mean, hers is quite a remarkable case. This is a woman in her 70s who actually started doing this in her youth. She would occasionally find herself getting up in the morning to go down to breakfast with her landlady, and her landlady would say, "Well, where have you been in the middle of the night? You stomped down the stairs with your helmet in your hand," and she had no recollection of this whatsoever. And then in later life had been witnessed by her neighbours driving up and down the promenade in the seaside town that she lived. So Jackie's experience is really at the very extremes of a condition called non-REM parasomnias, of which sleepwalking is really the typical manifestation. We know that sleepwalking, although it's very, very common in children, continues into adulthood in about 1% to 2% of individuals. And what we now understand happens during sleepwalking and related conditions is that whereas we used to think that sleep was an on or off state, so either the whole of the brain was asleep or the whole of the brain was awake, that actually different parts of the brain can exist in different states. And right. when people with sleepwalking or related conditions have been put in a scanner or had electrodes implanted in their brains, what we can see is that certain parts of the brain remain asleep, and those parts of the brain are typically an area of the brain called the frontal lobes, which are responsible for rational thinking or personality, and an area called the hippocampus, which is responsible for memory, are in very deep sleep. Whereas the areas of the brain that are responsible for movement, sometimes emotion, sometimes vision, are actually awake. So it's the fact that the brain is not in the same sleep state that results in these sorts of disorders.
Yeah. And Tom and Sarah, not their real names. So Tom suffers from sexsomnia, which is very, very rare.
Well, it's certainly something that we see relatively rarely. I suspect that it's probably rather more common in the population if you ask, because at various points sexsomnia has come up in the media, and after each time that's happened, I've certainly had lots of emails from various people saying, oh, I suffer from this as well. So this is really part of the umbrella of parasomnias. It's sexual behaviour in very deep sleep, and that's what Tom is experiencing.
And that's a fascinating story. We won't go into any more detail there. We have questions from our audience, and we're talking to Guy Leshner, and his book is The Nocturnal Brain. It's a fascinating read, and Guy's going to stay with us and answer your questions after a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
The Nocturnal Brain by Guy Leshner is a book. It's in bookshops now. I saw it in my local bookshop there the other day. Guy, insomnia, I didn't know there were two types of insomnia.
Well, there's probably more than two types of insomnia, actually. It's as with parasomnias, it's a bit of an umbrella term. It describes anybody who has poor quality sleep or limited sleep that's not due to the fact that they don't get into bed early enough or get out of bed too early, but have difficulty getting off to sleep or staying asleep. And people experience different things. So there are some people, for example, who will occasionally briefly wake up in the middle of the night, and their brain fills in the periods of time between which they're awake, and they convince themselves that they're awake during those periods, whereas actually when we record their brain waves, we can see that they're in very deep sleep. And then there are the people...
But before you move on from them, about that, I was confused about that, sleep state misperception. So they're getting a good bit of sleep, but still they must feel the effects of not getting sleep to present to you.
Yeah, well, they do. They complain of the fact that they feel really dreadful during the day, because I think it's important to stress that sleep is a subjective experience, and people can experience an unrefreshing sleep even in the context of having a sleep study that confirms that they are having really good quality sleep. Now, what we think is going on, at least in some individuals, is that actually there are subtle changes in the way that the brain sleeps, and perhaps it's important to stress that the EEG, which is the tool that we use to monitor brain waves, really only tells us about the surface of the brain, and we've still got quite a lot more to learn about what's going on in the whole brain, and it may be something about the way that their brain processes sleep that gives them that subjective experience.
Okay, so then there are people who genuinely only get 2 or 3 hours sleep.
The commonest form of that is people who have great difficulty switching their mind off. They get into bed, they feel sleepy, but once they get into bed, they feel very awake, and it's almost as if they've lost the switch in order to be able to get off to sleep. And that can be really debilitating, because it sets people into a vicious cycle whereby they have difficulty getting off to sleep. They start getting a bit anxious at the prospect of getting into bed because they dread the night ahead. And then they find that anxiety surrounding sleep actually makes the whole process of getting off to sleep more difficult, and so they end up in a very awful place. As I write in my book, there's nothing quite so lonely as the insomniac, because you're lying in bed in the middle of the night, wide awake, thinking that everybody else is asleep.
And you also say in the book that CBTI, as in cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia, is the way forward now for a lot of people.
Well, certainly it's the first step. It's almost the default first option in terms of getting people on an even keel with regard to their sleep. As you know, we used to use drugs very commonly, but in recent years we've very much moved away from rushing for the sleeping tablets, because we know that they're associated with particular problems like dependency, something called habituation, where people require ever increasing doses to obtain the same effect. And also in the long term, there are some bits of evidence that suggest that actually these drugs have long-term consequences in terms of cognition, in terms of memory. So we very much move towards non-drug-based treatment, this condition called cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, which really aims to address that vicious cycle that I was talking about, which is that anxiety about sleep, that poor association between being in bed and dropping off to sleep, which is replaced with an association between being in bed and struggling to get off to sleep, actively trying to sleep, really trying to retrain the brain back into a good sleep pattern.
Recondition it, yeah. Okay, so our listeners' questions. I've been told that several times a night I sound as if I'm smothering and then I gasp and resume sleeping. It may happen again or not, but usually once or twice a night. Help.
So that's a very common story that we see in the sleep clinic. The commonest cause for that is a condition called sleep apnea. So this is when the airway, as we drift deeper and deeper into sleep, becomes a little bit more floppy. And in some individuals, the airway is a bit narrower than normal or a bit floppier than normal. That can be related to the shape of our airway, but it can also be related to having large tonsils or some other abnormality within the airway. But the commonest association is with carrying excess weight, particularly on the throat. As the airway becomes more floppy, in some individuals, the airway actually ends up being completely obstructed. And so that causes you to be breathing against a closed airway. That causes your heart rate to go up, your oxygen levels to drop down. You partially wake, and then as you partially wake, the airway opens up again. And in some individuals, that results in them fully waking up with a sensation of choking or gasping. There are some other possible explanations for that, but that's by far the most likely explanation.
And you talk a lot about sleep apnea in the book, and it's not just a disruption of sleep, it has knock-on physical effects on you.
Yeah, we now understand that sleep apnea is associated with a whole range of other conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, stroke, heart disease, a whole range of conditions. And what we now are also looking at is whether or not there's an association between obstructive sleep apnea and Alzheimer's disease. Because in addition to what we talked about in terms of the lymphatic system and the removal of toxins from the brain, what also tends to happen is if your brain is continuously being starved of oxygen repeatedly throughout the night, and sometimes this can occur up to 100 times an hour, so it's a staggering the amount of times that this can disrupt your sleep, then that can also result in some changes, some biochemical changes within the brain that may also put you at risk of conditions like Alzheimer's disease.
How do you treat apnea then, sleep apnea?
So the gold standard treatment for people with severe sleep apnea is a treatment called CPAP or APAP. This is a mask that is applied to the face. A seal is made between the mask and the face, and the mask is connected to a small device that generates positive pressure. So essentially what you're doing is you're breathing against resistance, and that positive pressure keeps the airway open and stops it from collapsing down in sleep. There are a number of other treatments, but that is probably the most commonly used treatment.
Sounds very uncomfortable, Guy.
It is potentially uncomfortable, but what you have to remember is that a lot of people with severe sleep apnea feel dreadful during the day. They're excessively sleepy, they feel awful because their sleep is being disrupted several times an hour, and in many cases this mask can be life-changing. Okay. It can change somebody from being excessively sleepy, from dozing off at every possible opportunity, to really getting their life back. And a lot of people have a love-hate relationship with their CPAP. They hate the fact that they have to wear it every night, but they love the fact that they feel rejuvenated by it.
Will you talk about sleep problems in the menopause, please?
So I think that we know that there is a strong association between fluctuations in hormones in women and sleep quality. A lot of women complain of poor sleep in the few days before their periods, but those hormonal changes also that occur in the menopause can also give rise to hot flushes, which can disrupt the quality of sleep. And women often complain of very poor sleep as they go through the menopause. I think the key thing in that situation is obviously If your GP feels that HRT is appropriate, then that will sort the issue out. But the other thing to do is to concentrate on other aspects of your sleep to see if there's anything that you can do from a lifestyle perspective to try and improve the quality of your sleep. Simple things like avoiding too much caffeine, making sure you have regular sleep hours, making sure your environment is as comfortable as possible. One of the other issues that is often associated with hormonal fluctuations is a condition called restless leg syndrome, which is a neurological disorder that gives rise to a sensation of discomfort, usually in the legs, that's associated with an urge to move. And that can cause marked disruption of sleep, in particularly in women, although it affects men as well.
We won't get to all of the questions today, Guy, but we speak regularly to John Garvey, who you know, and he always reminds us about good sleep hygiene. And one of the things is about technology late at night. And you talk in your book about the Zeitgeber, is it Zeitgeber?
Zeitgeber.
Tell people about that.
So we know that our circadian rhythm, our internal body clock, which sits in a part of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, is to some extent defined by our genes. So that some people, for example, are morning larks, some people are evening owls, and some people run on a standard 24-hour clock. But that internal body clock can also be influenced by external factors. It's not purely down to our genes. Psychological factors and, importantly, environmental factors like light, particularly blue light. There are direct connections between cells in the back of our eyes, in the retina, and the area of the brain that's responsible for regulating our internal body clock. And we know that if you expose yourself to blue light, particularly in the evenings, then what you're doing is you're messing with your internal body clock. You're pushing the internal body clock back, and actually you're affecting levels of a hormone called melatonin, which is an important signal from the brain to other parts of the brain, but also the rest of the body, that it's time to go to sleep. In fact, we know that if you expose yourself to bright light in the evenings, you can suppress your melatonin very, very well indeed. And so that can have important implications for your body clock, but it can also have important implications for the quality of your sleep.
Okay. Finally then, because I said I'd ask you about this, shift working. How detrimental is that to your health?
Well, I think it's detrimental in a number of ways. Essentially, if you are a shift worker, then you're trying to be awake and be asleep at times that your body clock is telling you otherwise. And so that has implications in terms of the quality of your sleep, but it can also result in people being chronically sleep deprived as well. And we know that that obviously has consequences in terms of how you feel during the day, but it can also have long-term health consequences. And in fact, the World Health Organization has recently added shift work to their list of possible carcinogens, things that might put you at risk of cancer. So the answer to that is probably that there is quite a significant negative impact of shift work on our general health.
Okay. So the nocturnal brain, Guy Leschner, Leschzinor, if you're looking for it in your shop or on Kindle or wherever. It's a really interesting read, and I really enjoyed our chat. Guy, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ray.